We are delighted that this week's episode is sponsored by The Animal Guys, who tour the UK and Europe educating audiences about all creatures, great and small.
Having just completed a sellout theatre tour, what makes The Animal Guys different is they've developed an entire show that involves no live animals.
They truly believe in learning through laughter and educating families today so that we can save the animals of tomorrow.
To find out more and for tickets to their tour, just Google The Animal Guys. Please note that this episode contains references to addictions, including sex, gambling, and substance use. There are also references to suicide and the loss of a child, which some people may find distressing.
I've been affected by alcoholism my entire life. And in the past, I've suffered with an addiction to food, to chocolate, to Pepsi Max, to exercise, even, you know, cigarettes, overwork. And literally anyone can be affected by addiction. Addiction is often a taboo subject. It's something that we feel ashamed of, whether it's us or a family member, something that we might feel sort of guilty or embarrassed about. And as I see it, addiction realistically is a form of self-medicating or a form of self-harm or a form of self-sabotage. And knowing that so many people even struggle to admit that they're struggling with some form of addiction, we both feel so incredibly blessed that 18 years ago, somebody came to see us asking for help. And for the first time in 18 years, we're seeing that person again. And that is wonderful Paul Ribbons, who has kindly come to join us on our family podcast Handbook to Happiness. Hi, Paul.
Welcome, Paul.
Welcome. Thank you
so
very much.
I know that was 2006, but you know the actual date, don't you?
17th of February. Really? 16th of February was the last time I actually took a drink. And I said to my wife at the time, this is the last drink I'll ever have. I popped along to see you and I've never looked back since.
Wow. So 17th of February, 2006.
Wow. That is pretty amazing. And what's really amazing, actually, Paul, is that literally it's been that long. Saw you today for the first time and he looks no flipping
different. He looks no different.
Does he? I mean, like, literally, you look incredible. So, honestly, we're so grateful that you've come to talk to us today, because I think addiction is something that is an embarrassed, like, people feel embarrassed about talking. But also, I think there's a huge element of belief that when somebody's addicted, it's very much orientated around avoidance, willpower, you know, just trying to sort of talk, have some positive self-talk, being hard with yourself. And I don't really think that's obviously not our methodology and not our way. But tell us your story. Tell us why you came to see us, what was going on in your life and where you are now.
Yeah, it was something I was aware of for many, many years. And it's interesting because I know a lot of people start drinking early. I didn't actually drink that early, even though I grew up in a environment where I had a step uncle who was an alcoholic and drug addict, and he would ridicule me for not drinking any alcohol even at sort of 12, 13 years of age. And I used to look at him and think, I don't want to be like him. I never want to be like him. And he was a horrible man. My mother had passed away when I was three, and my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, he was an alcoholic, and today I understand why he became an alcoholic, because his daughter had died, and she was 23 when she died, and he couldn't handle it, so he turned to alcohol, and that, he drank himself to death in the end. So I grew up with alcohol around me in a negative way, and I didn't like it. And then when I got through my teens, I had a few drinks and it was okay. And it wasn't until I got older, and I think it was probably around a sort of time when my kids were quite young, and I'd got divorced, and I realized that I was drinking more often, and I didn't recognize the link between when my kids were 2-3 years of age, because I was 3 when my mum died and they were 3, and I was looking at them, and I think that triggered the trauma from my childhood and growing up with a stepmother and a poor environment, and I was numbing the pain effectively, because it brought the pain up, you see.
Of course.
So I was aware of this growing up. As they were growing up, and I used to literally drop them off to their mothers, race back to get to the pub, and then bang, and then I'd be there for quite a while, and then I'd probably have 2 or 3 days, and then I'd stop and then go and pick the kids up. Never used to drink around them, always avoided it, and then I realised that the more successful I got, the more time I had on my hands, the more money I had, the more habitually come. Every day I was drinking, virtually every day. It was either, the deal's gone wrong, so I go in the pub. Or I've done a blinding deal, so I go in the pub. I feel a bit down today, I'll go in the pub. And I remember it started off with a Monday club. It was, on a Monday, it used to be, and I have got that sort of personality where I like to do things different. Everyone's working, I don't want to be working. I want to be doing my own thing. So I formed this little Monday club, 1 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. We go down the pub and absolutely asked, and then it became a Tuesday club, and then it came out a Wednesday club, and so I always stopped when the kids were around, but I just noticed it was more often.
So could I ask, because you stopped drinking when your kids were around, would I be right in saying that was your justification that you don't actually have a problem?
Yeah, I didn't think I had a problem. Yeah. And the people around me were drinking the same level as I was. And this is the thing, my threshold's quite low for alcohol. So I'll have one straight to the head. It's like, well, I've got me fixed, really. I've already got me. Because if you think about drink, you're changing the way you feel. You're
exactly.
Trying to hide.
Well, you didn't
stop
at one, though, did you?
I didn't go too mad. I wouldn't binge. Like, I would 3 or 4 and I'd be finished. I know mates of mine would do, 10 or 11 drinks, but 3 or 4 and I'd be finished. But I'd probably stretch the last one out for quite a while. And then over a course of time, it was, I justified it. It was what we did.
Yeah.
People did that. Yeah. But I noticed it was causing problems, because alcohol doesn't just affect you, it affects the people around you.
Yeah.
When you go home and you're a little bit tipsy and someone says, oh, you've been down the pub again. What do you mean again? What do you mean again? You're trying to justify it.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, that justification now, knowing that you don't drink, do you look at other people and go, they're just justifying that, and you can see through it?
Yeah, I can see through it. But I saw it through it then as well. So yeah. I think you are aware of it. People are aware of it.
Right.
And it got to the stage where, especially before we moved house, a pub was literally 150 yards from our house. And I'd leave the car there, walk home, or stagger home, or whatever you want to call it. But I'd never go out of an evening. I always used to do my drinking in the afternoon. That was another justification. I didn't have a problem because I wasn't out with everybody else, was I?
Yeah.
Isn't it funny how, as well, I think that when you've got addiction, we often do, we compare ourselves to other people that are worse, and that makes us feel better.
Yeah.
And it's a big thing, though, because, I mean, it's interesting because there's a thing in psychology, a science corner, called cognitive dissonance, which is the fact that we cannot cope with knowing one thing and doing another, right? So it doesn't make sense. How can people drink alcohol? How can people smoke when they know, logically speaking, that it's damaging their health, right? It's a problem. It's making them ill. It's making them not live as long. But yet we still do it. So the reason why we still do it is we have to justify it to ourselves so that we can fix that cognitive dissonance, that kind of confusion between, the confusion between what we know and what we're doing, because we can't go through life doing something that we know is wrong. We have to justify it. So to do that, we compare ourselves to people that are worse than us. So then, Paul's saying that, but I wasn't going out in the evening and I wasn't doing it around my kids, so it's not that bad. Yeah. So when people then do face him with it, you can go, well, it's not a problem.
And I had four drinks before and I couldn't cope with anymore, but some people have 8.
Exactly.
Always, and being the child of somebody, an alcoholic, I sort of get all of that. And yeah. It's so interesting to listen to you speaking, Paul, because there's so many similarities in that, you know, there was always justification made. There was always, yeah, but I'm not as bad as. Mm. And I think that my parent didn't realize, you know, they was again, you know, I understand why it was definitely self-medication, but what they didn't also see is because they were the only one that was working, they would go to the pub, but there'd be people there that weren't, and the person that would be buying the drinks will be my family member. So suddenly it feels like, you know, I'm dead popular as well and all that. And interestingly, it is, again, the justification. It's amazing how when you have an addiction, and that doesn't matter because there's addictions, you can have an addiction to anything, you know, there's the obvious alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, but then there's the less obvious, which is
sugar.
Food, Pepsi Max was one of mine, exercise, gambling, tattooing.
Social media.
Social media. We even know somebody.
Sex as well.
Sex, and then also tanning, you know, like actual taking tanning injections and tanning tablets. So, and there's always a positive intent behind it. So that might be, I just need to numb a pain. I just need to forget. It might be because I want to be around other people. I'm trying to run away from something. It might be because, well, I saw that at home. That was my parents' go-to when they were stressed. So I'll
do
that
too. And I think that's what Paul was saying there, because he knew that he didn't want to go down that route.
Yeah.
But then when he was in a bad situation where, you know, all these traumas were coming up, that was the route that he'd seen
absolutely.
As how do I medicate? This is what you do.
So,
but I think that you hit a really good point there. Until I had kids, I didn't realize, because I blanked it all out. I'd stuffed it in a box and left it there, and so it never. If it did come up, it was my way of coping. I just numbed, I could deal with it.
Did but you know when, it was there? Was it niggling at you?
It's funny because October 2022, my daughter took her own life. My trans daughter. And that was like, it's like someone had detonated a nuclear bomb, because I wasn't, I can't stress losing, you don't bury your kids. And that's why I said to you earlier, I could understand my grandfather's pain then, why he went down that route. And I was so fortunate. And I thank you guys so much, because if I had been drinking then, I would have probably gone the same way as my grandfather.
That must have been, you know, knowing that at any point where you feel like I need some respite, I just want my head to switch off. I mean, I'm so sorry, Paul. I can't even begin to imagine how that, like, genuinely, the loss of a child. You know, my kids are here with us today, and gosh, the thought of ever losing your child is just beyond any pain I could ever imagine. So, did you ever at that point, was it ever a consideration?
Never. And the first time she tried to take her own life was back in 2012. And even then, I'd never thought about picking a drink. I mean, do you know why? Because I don't see myself as a drink. I see myself as teetotal. And when I first came to see you guys, that was my goal. My goal was not to stop drinking, to be teetotal.
I mean, we sort of
I remember it very well, because, and more so, because I remember when concluding the session with you, that you were sat in your car for ages. Mm. And I was wondering what happened to you. I was getting really concerned.
Yeah, like, it's not going. It's getting a bit of a loitering.
Deleting all these numbers out of your phone.
Yeah, the drinkers,
That was part of the thing that we said. I remember that. I do remember saying that obviously there was people that were kind of egging you on, peer pressure, that, and you sort of said, and we talked about draggers in our worlds, which is something that we advocate about, checking people who bring you down.
But also, they weren't real friends.
They weren't.
Buying the drinks.
Yeah. You were sat in their car there on the delete button.
That's it.
Giggle about that.
But there was a couple of my mates, in fact one of my mates and his father were both real bad alcoholics, and he said to me, look, why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I went, really? He said, just come along. And I went to a couple of sessions with Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I'm sitting there, and they always say, don't look at the differences, look at the similarities. But there's straight away, I'm not as bad as that guy. And I couldn't go back. I couldn't, because I will say this, I have been back from a teetotal perspective to help other people, because I can see it in other people and how they're a little bit in the right guidance.
Yeah.
Because they've got this label. They've got this label. I've got this alcoholic label. And they don't have to label themselves.
And that was obviously where that you were fighting with that as well. So you came to see us. That was 18 years ago. You haven't touched any alcohol since. Has it been difficult?
No. It was never difficult. So as soon as I walked out and cleared all their numbers off my phone, it was not difficult at all. There have been times where I've took a lot of stick over it, but I'm quite strong anyway. So I just, it's just rubber bullets.
So yeah, I was going to say that one thing that once you, so when you want to quit anything, the first thing is making the decision. That's got to be the first thing. But then the second thing that you've also got to consider is removing the temptation and keeping away from people that assist the temptation. So you'll be around people who, and those people you say, well, I actually don't drink alcohol anymore. And they invariably will say, one won't do you any harm. Just have one. So how did you deal with that stuff?
I'm teetotal. That's what I said to him. I'm teetotal. I don't want a drink. Thank you very much. I'll have this glass of water. My mates call me Perrier because that's what I drink, Perrier water, yeah. Sparkling water. To me, it was really easy. It's not hard. And in fact, I would suggest that I've probably inspired more than
those.
And one of my neighbours moved in after I'd stopped drinking, and we went to the yacht club, and he said to me, what's your poison, effectively? And I said,
people say that.
Yeah, they do. What's your poison? Sparkling water. He went, oh, okay. And he sort of touched on it. And then the next time I saw him, he said, you've inspired me. I'm going to give up drinking, and that's it. And he hasn't drunk since.
Amazing.
Not a thing. Again, successful guy. And he used to play golf. He used to go, to the yacht club. And they're all drinking cultures, And one of the, I'm in the property industry. And when I first left the baking industry to get into a estate agency, there was a drinking culture. There is a drinking, general drink. And so you are ridiculed for not participating. But, it's having that resolve to say, no. My identity changed. That's the difference. When I left your house, my identity
changed. But your social life didn't change, did it? As in...
I think it did, yeah.
But I know you don't go to the pub maybe so much now because you weren't being around people that you wanted to, but does it stop you... has it expanded in a different way,
It's funny. Do you remember I said to you earlier, I didn't drink of an evening. If we went out as a family, I wouldn't drink. I'd go in the afternoon.
So that didn't change.
That didn't change at all. It was that habit of going out in the afternoon and having that freedom. Because one of the things... we said on my list of important things was freedom.
Yes.
And that was, it was like I was justifying my freedom by going in the pub when everyone else was at work. So it was, to me, it was, and that was really fueling it, making it feel, so I'd do it even more.
But also, obviously, we questioned your values and beliefs, and that was the big button to push. But you also had the trauma of losing your mum when you're 3 years of age. Mm. And then your dad... remarrying or finding a new partner, I can't remember which one it was, who wasn't very nice to you.
And I think that's a really good point, though, is because obviously Paul's saying that he found it easy, but I think when you deal with the right thing that you're self-medicating, it is easy because I think that, there'll be so many people listening. Yes, there'll be so many people listening that might be struggling with an addiction of any one of those things you mentioned earlier and be trying with the willpower, right? Trying to, avoid it, keep away from certain people, whatever it might be. But until you deal with the actual start point, then you can stop it. You can't, don't get me wrong, you can avoid alcohol.
You can, but it's always. It's a constant.
But it's always open.
When it comes to any kind of addiction, the sort of formula is find why you're self-medicating and address that. Mm. Look at your current circle and environment, and is that contributing? That's another part. And then another part is to find that leverage as to, why do I deserve not to harm myself any longer? Why do I deserve to be better, healthier, more in control and freer? And so is it possible, I know that a lot of people think, if you've been addicted to something, then, you're never free of it. Well, the only reason people do get addicted is because they're self-medicating. It's like putting a plaster on an emotional wound. So help that emotional wound to heal and the plaster is no longer necessary.
Yeah. Within that, I think we had a couple of sessions and we were dealing with the emotional trauma that was behind that. And I think that's really important for people to understand, because if you don't deal with that, like exactly what happened with me. It can resurface.
Well, that emotional trauma and in any event, because what you've got to consider is that, and most people's emotional traumas, because they're in context, tend to happen in childhood. And those are the things that we then struggle with later on in life. And even though we think we've boxed them away, but they will resurface. For you, I know that, right, losing your mom, try and understand that, right? You can't.
I've got two grandchildren. Both, one's 2.5 and one's 3. Well, one's gone up for 3 and one's 3.5. So I'm looking at them again now. This is another generation later, yeah. Looking at them, little kids. And I said to Yvette, my wife, the other day, just look at your little grandson, right? Imagine his mum disappearing tomorrow. You know, never coming back. How would that kid deal with it?
And how they'll deal with it is individual, and it's based on the people around them and what stories they're told. But you lost your mum, and then your dad doing the best thing he can, trying to bring someone in to help run the household, bring someone on who doesn't treat you well. So then when they don't treat you well, do you resent them, or do you think, well, actually, I must deserve to be punished, right? Mm. And therefore, I'm someone that deserves for things to go bad for. Yeah. And then you, where they finish bullying you, if I use that word,
yeah, it's a good word,
you
yeah.
then carry it on yeah. because you believe that they've taught you that you deserve yeah, that.
Yeah, so you yeah, then yeah, continue yeah. the self-bullying with the...
So you have low self-esteem and then...
Exactly.
You
yeah. exactly.
And all the time you know that drinking alcohol was punishing you in a way and holding you back. And, you know, whilst you were successful, you could have been a lot more successful if you weren't drinking. You think, well, I just deserve to feel this bad.
Mm. So, Paul, we have our podcast is called Handbook to Happiness. And for our listeners, we're going to add something into our metaphorical Handbook to Happiness to help others out there who are watching or listening. What would you have some words of wisdom to add?
You're only as happy as you make up your mind to be. Because if you think about happiness, everyone's looking for exterior things to make them happy, aren't they? If you think about that logically, right? When I get this, I'll be happy. When I do this, I'll be happy. When I do this, I'll be happy. But actually, why can't you just bring that forward and be happy now? And if that happens, that's fantastic. So I would say you're only as happy as you make your mind up to be. So make your mind up to be happy and enjoy it.
I love that. It's like listening to myself.
Honestly, you two have got so much in common.
I was only talking about this yesterday with Liv, that if you pin your happiness on external sources, what if it never happens? What you're saying is that I can never be happy, right? So what can we do today to make us happy now? And the answer to that is always gratitude. It's always gratitude and looking around and looking at what we've got in our lives.
So can I tell you the biggest thing that blew my mind today was that Paul actually recalled a joke of yours, Nick, right? and not just that, it gets worse.
Yeah.
And he actually went, I remember a joke that you said and it was really funny. And me and Liv, I roll, both of us.
Yeah, right? We just kept quiet.
So I think that, I think
And what Paul was amazing is that he remembered it. I'd forgotten it. But it is a super funny joke.
So go on, Paul. Go on, give us, what was that joke of Nick's that you recall?
So there's this bloke walking along and pushing this trolley, this supermarket trolley. Inside it was a rabbit's foot, a four-leaf clover, and a horseshoe. And he said, "You're pushing your luck."
It's great.
I don't know. I mean...
They're
just bad. Honestly, they used to have got so much
Thanks,
in common.
Paul.
So thank you so much, Paul. First of all, just for actually walking through our door 18 years ago, actually.
Yeah, thank you.
Because we do talk about you.
What was that date in 2006 again?
17th of February.
2006.
Well, thank you for walking through our door on the 17th of February 2006 for trusting in us. You know, your story has inspired a lot of people. You've inspired a lot of people. You've inspired people that we don't even know that you've mentioned. You are proof of our theory that people become addicted not because it's a choice and they think it's a good idea, not because they want to hurt their families, not because they want to make anybody's life miserable. And, you know, like I said, as a kid, that's what I felt. That is never the intention. It's because of some form of self-medication and deal with the emotional wound. And then the self-medication becomes unnecessary. And I know that you do you know, you are just like an amazing, amazing person who goes on and helps and inspires other people. And I just think that that's amazing. I genuinely think
can I just make a point there, because you said about inspiring people. I had someone contact me recently. She went to me. I've just read, because I wrote a book a few years ago.
You can give it a plug if you want. What's your blog book called? Go on.
Hustle Your Way to Property Success. She'd read the book, and she went, I know you. And I went, really? She went, yeah, Nick and Eva. She'd been to one of your events, and she'd seen my video that I did for you a few years ago. And she went, wow. Yeah, you're the guy on the video.
Wow.
Yeah, and we do.
And you do inspire a lot of people. Mm. We do at our workshops. We do talk about you, that video that you sent was just incredible. Mm. It was just so poignant, so to the point, and it has made such a difference to so many people. Even if it was just the belief, I'm addicted, I can get better. Because once you've got that mindset, you know that from then you're going in the right direction. You're asking for help. You're becoming aware of it. You're accepting it. You're not justifying it. So from all of us, honestly, a huge, huge thank you to Paul. I think you've been amazing. Paul. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
So, Hunter, you heard Paul talking about addictions. Are you aware of addictions in your life, in your circles?
Yeah, massively, especially at uni. Not even during the weekends, during the weekdays. I mean, I always go to university in the US, and marijuana is legal over there, and it seems like because there's not quite the same stigma around it over there, that people will use that as a crutch to get through the week when they're stressed. Even like Tuesday went like middle of the week, just like towards the end of the day, and just really using it as a crutch. Even at my age of like 19, which doesn't really seem like it seems quite early to be doing that when there's not really as much on your plate at this point, it feels. I think really just accessibility is a big issue, and just kind of the way that especially in the UK, that alcohol is seen is just so accessible.
It's not
seen as an issue, and especially for younger people, it's like you're 18, fine, you can drink now, and suddenly it's like the stigma of drinking is removed, and at that point, it's kind of like
and again,
but that doesn't apply in America though, doesn't it? Because you can't drink it. Well, you can't,
and that's why I think, I don't know, it's very different over there, but that's why I think weed is such a big thing, because it's like it's not got the same negative associations with it.
So knowing that marijuana is legal in America at uni, do you find that is there any pressure associated with it for you there?
I think there has been with some people that I've been around. Most of the time there isn't really. It's just kind of, it's just very prominent, I would say, more than being pressure. I'd say it's just very, very prominent.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, Paul made a really good point about who you surround yourself with. And I think there is sort of a few pronged approach really when it comes to addiction. Obviously, like we said, one big one is dealing with why do you need to self-medicate, because if you take that away then you don't need anything. The second one is finding better coping mechanisms so that you've got something else to go to, because everybody gets stressed, like Hunter said, you know, they use as a crutch for uni stress, so finding a better sort of resolution for uni stress. And the third one is looking at who you're surrounding yourself with, you know, is that peer pressure, is that groups that, because it's like I said before about cognitive dissonance, and we compare ourselves to the people around us. If everybody around you is smoking weed, then you're not going to think smoking weed's a problem, but if everyone around you isn't and you're the only one, you would feel that it was a problem, right? It's looking at who you're around. And I remember even when I was at university that, I mean, I was quite lucky because there were people in my friendship group that went into drugs, but equally, in fairness, they were very, very like, you know, I want to do this but you don't have to, and very respectful of those of us. I think I had quite a mixed friendship group, and the people in my friendship group that didn't do those things, there was never any pressure, and I was quite impressed with that with them, that they were like, we're gonna do this but you don't have to, and there was never any pressure there. And I think that makes a difference, because when you've got the choice, you know, then you don't have to go into that route, whereas that choice can be taken away either by people or by your past and sort of needing to medicate, because
I self-medicated so much through my life, particularly before I met your dad. So, you know, I did have an issue with food, and that was very much associated with, you know, I felt bad, so eating something would help me to feel good. I never turned to alcohol ever, but I did drink, I did smoke, I did overeat, and I had literally Pepsi Max was, you know, and I'm not the only one. I've heard of many people that have had that same, because it was quite sweet, even though it was sugar free, it was quite sweet. So I had that, and it was literally just to help myself just feel just that little bit better in the moment.
Do you not think that's why as well though, that when people try and get over an addiction without dealing with the cause. Oh, so, you completely. Know, like they say, like they just say, right, that's it, I'm not going to drink, and they'll count however many days it, or whatever.
Definitely.
It replaces with something else.
Absolutely.
Because you've still not healed the wound. So you just try and find a different medication.
Different vice.
And you're spot on with that, because for me, okay, so I smoked, met your dad. Dad wasn't a smoker, but he was a meat eater. I wasn't.
Yeah.
And so because I love animals so much, and I know he doesn't eat meat now, but back then he did, I was like, you know, if you quit eating meat, I'll stop smoking. And he did. So that was like, the leverage on that was huge.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you though, when I met him, I'm just putting it out there. When we first met and I smoked, I had no intention of giving up. And we first met and I didn't think it was going to go beyond a couple of days, and he said something like, oh, I don't like smoking. And we met in the sort of, I don't know, October. We met in the August, but we actually sort of started dating in the October. And I was like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm giving up for New Year. No intention at all of quitting smoking, because I didn't think I'd still be with him. And then lo and behold, we come to the 31st of December and it was like, I'm still with him. So, and he said he'll quit me. So it was like, well, no brainer, I can't. And I'm so stubborn. It was like, I'll have to quit smoking then.
But do you think that you replace that with anything? I don't know what the timeline. So
Yeah, I did. I then replaced it with sugary foods and
until you dealt with everything.
Yeah. And then I remember it was really interesting, because a lot of people do say, oh yeah, but if, you know, I don't want to quit smoking because I'll put weight on. But that's not why it's not the smoking. It's because you're then looking, you're deferring that self-medication to something else.
And usually it's food, which
because it's accessible. Absolutely.
But interestingly, because Paul was talking about alcohol, and why didn't you replace it with alcohol?
Probably because I had such a negative association with alcohol, because
so
of what
Paul,
I'd seen
though.
In my life.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? But you found something else, so you didn't need to.
Yeah, and it just was, I didn't want to blame my family member for it, so I blamed alcohol, though. Mm. So for me, alcohol was just like, you've ruined my life and you've made my life really difficult. So yeah, you know, I'm not saying that I'm teetotal, because I'm absolutely not, but I'm not, I mean, I don't know. I just hardly ever drink. Yeah. I don't get.
But also, you've dealt with those things now, so you don't need anything to self-medicate.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly true.
And
now,
I think this is the thing that, you know, all addiction, just to bring some more science corner in here, that, you know, this all comes down to whenever we do all these things, whether it be drinking or whether it be drugs or whether it be smoking, it gives us this dopamine release, which is a surge of feel-good chemicals in the brain. And you know, that feels good, makes us feel good. And then people can chase that more and more and more. So when they've got a wound that they need to feel good, because they're not feeling happy in themselves, because they're not feeling those normal dopamine rushes that we would, you know, normally get day to day, they're going to other substances to get that artificially. And the problem with that is that then actually our brain adjusts to that level. So we never actually feel as good, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So,
you know,
like for example, you know, when people, you know, will go to food, for example, they'll eat the food and they might get this dopamine surge, but then eventually the brain will adjust to sort of expect that level of dopamine. So then suddenly now when we get that, it doesn't feel any good. Mm. So you keep trying to chase it and you don't ever get there, which is why actually I find it interesting that, you know, something fascinating. So I work with an incredible lecturer in behavioral neuroscience at Oxford, a guy called Robin. He was amazing, Robin Murphy. And he all researches into addiction and neuroscience, and yeah, he's just fascinating. But one of the things that we were talking about is gambling in Vegas and the old machines. And one thing was, the old gambling machines in Vegas would give big payouts, but very, very rarely. And they realized that actually people's brains don't work well with that. So what they now do is give lots of little payouts. So you get lots of little dopamine hits. So then they get all these feel good feelings, associate that with the machine, and there goes a gambling addiction, which is great for the casinos because they make loads of money. Wow. Whereas if you were only getting these, you know, big wins, but very, very rarely, how much dopamine are you getting? You might sit and play for ages and get none. So you're not going to feel great about the machine.
God,
so it hooks people into playing more, which is crazy. But this is what we do. But the bottom line comes down to, you know, if you don't have a need to search for that adrenaline, dopamine rush and adrenaline, then you don't need to medicate with anything.
Yeah. No, that completely makes sense. I also think that, and this is just from my own observation as a former sort of chocolate and sort of food addict, that when you have an addiction, you're almost looking, you're searching for catastrophes so that you can justify eating something, you know, you're looking for, oh, well, something went wrong today at work. And then you can go, so I'm going to have to go home and have a curry and a bar of chocolate. And I did that. So I know that that is. And so what you're actually doing is not only does the addiction make you feel bad because you sort of think, oh, why did I do that? But also it sort of programs you to look for drama so that you can justify having something.
Which doesn't make life feel any better, but also you're lying to yourself. I mean, ultimately, that's what you're doing. You're trying to find a justification that is based on a complete untrue that you can sell to yourself to make yourself feel better.
But
it's all a pot of lies.
Completely.
Really.
And I was self-sabotaging. You know, I felt absolutely crap about myself. I'd been told on, you know, pretty much all my life from somebody or other, from bullies, you know, that I wasn't good enough, that I was fat, that I was ugly, that I was stupid. And so I felt that bad about myself that, like we were saying with Paul, I was continuing that sort of barrage of pain on myself. I took over where the bullies left off and I was hurting myself. And so, yeah, it is about dealing with those past issues. It is about building yourself up. It is about checking out your environment. And anybody, you know, as I say, I've kind of been there with food and chocolate, that, you know, you still can get through it.
It's not, even though right now you are doing that, it's because of someone's made you feel a certain way before, you know? So people can't feel bad about themselves if they are self-medicating because it's not their fault. It was never them that started this off, right? It's absolutely not their fault.
Absolutely not their fault.
It's about sort of realizing where it comes from, because even I was thinking before about social media, even social media now has become addictive because it's filled that void of getting, you know, being able to, you know, you can put a picture up and you can get loads of likes and you get that dopamine release because you're getting validation. And if you're someone that's come from, you know, a household where you've had no validation, you've never felt good enough, suddenly you're getting loads of it from loads of people, you know, because you can reach, reach so many people that you never otherwise.
True.
Now suddenly I'm getting massive amounts of validation or feel good, you know. So
that makes sense.
Totally understandable that all these things are the same thing, which is all looking for some, you know, something to make them feel good, because for whatever reason you've not felt good in your past, and you've got to go back to what that is, deal with that, whether that be with a therapist or going through self-help or, you know, whatever needs to happen. That's what you need to start working through, and not being hard on yourself and feeling like there's something wrong with you.
And I think asking yourself, what's my positive intent? Because I don't think, you know, nobody has an addiction from choice, whether that's food, gambling, alcohol, smoking, drugs, whatever it might be. There is a positive intent behind an addiction, and that positive intent might be numbing a pain. It might be self-sabotage. It might be just to take your mind off it. It might be to belong to another group of people. It might be to be like a parent and have some sort of a commonality. So it, once you know what that positive intent is, because that's what's encouraging it, then you can start to address that
The cause then, so then you can fix it.
Absolutely,
right? Until you know that, until you try and identify that, you can feel like, I just don't know why I feel this way. I don't know why I have to do this. But if you understand it, that's already the battle, you know, starting the battle, because you've got there and you can figure that out and counteract whatever that answer is.
I think even just having that can make it feel so much more bearable, understandable. Because once you know what it is and understand it better, than feeling like completely out of control, that can make a big difference as well.
Yeah. What would everybody's go-to be? So like, I'm feeling a bit down. What would your go-to be like for us? And because mine.
I was just going to say, I would say an amazing one, if people haven't tried it, I think, is meditation. And I know a lot of people think, oh, but I can't meditate, I've got too much going on in my mind. Trust me, I've been there. But you've got to just kind of persevere with it. And even if you do have thoughts swirling in your mind, that's okay. Like, you learn as you try to meditate to just acknowledge that and go, yeah, that's cool, I'll think about that later. But it really calms the brain and it actually releases dopamine. That is a dopamine release by meditating. So you're calming yourself down, you're slowing down the brain's processing, and also you're releasing dopamine. So that actually can really, really help and is a great tool to just switch off and give yourself permission to switch off for a few minutes.
And that's great. And if you are struggling with how to get started meditating, get yourself, you know, in a calm environment, get ready to start meditating, and then ask yourself the question, I wonder what my next thought's going to be.
It silences.
And I'd say guided meditation if anyone's never meditated before, because you might just think, what do I do? Just sit there.
Yep.
But there's great YouTube. Guided meditations on YouTube. You know, I rave all the time about my man, Jason Stevenson. You're sick of hearing his name, I know. But yeah, there's a guy called Jason Stevenson on YouTube that does like guided meditations of all sorts of lengths and sizes, and they are amazing. So I'd say for me, that would be my go-to for a de-stress.
Hunter, what's your de-stress?
I think cardio, but specifically going out.
I like going on the bike, really.
I just kind of feel like I just feel like I'm escaping something, just for a bit. I just get some headspace from it and just kind of focus on something else and just
getting some oxygen.
And also endorphins as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So. I mean, I've got to be honest. One of mine is exercise, definitely.
Which is also a dopamine. Yeah,
it is a dopamine release. And if I feel agitated or overwhelmed, I do feel like I really need to go to the gym and I need to do something. And I know that takes my mind off it. And I've got to be honest, there are occasions where sometimes it's just doing a bit of ironing and watching something on Netflix.
You're the only woman that enjoys ironing.
Well, I don't really. It switches my brain off.
Yeah, I
just
feel it does. I said this to you. Sometimes I think doing something with your hands is really good. So like some people like colouring or cross stitching or drawing or whatever. Or painting. So for you, I think that's your doing something with your hands.
It is. And I've got to say that. And again, this is something we'll talk about in another episode, which we're going to be talking about weight loss. And obviously that's one of the sort of things, it's really important to have something to do with your hands, but we'll save that for another day. But I know we're doing a masterclass about that, which is very exciting. Nick, what's your go-to?
Lifting weights.
Yeah.
Yeah. And lifting something heavier.
Than the burden you might be feeling.
Yeah. Because then all you're focusing on and being able to lift or push that or pull that weight, and it just takes your mind away.
Music's good as well, don't you think?
Yeah, well, music is a great way to change your state, because if you put on your feel good song, and everyone should have a list of feel good songs.
Ballroom Blitz.
They will change you. Sweet or amazing. Yeah.
Do you know what? Do you know what? Me and Hunter's got a favorite show. Do you remember the Sarah Jane Adventures?
I do.
It's like the Doctor Who offshoot thing.
Yeah.
Hunter's always loved that. And actually, when we were kids, do you not remember? When we were kids, Dad didn't tell us that there was a cap on our Wi-Fi, that we can only use so much internet. And Hunter took it upon himself to download.
No, that was you that did that. I'm 100%.
No, I swear to God, it wasn't. And it was like he downloaded like 15 episodes of the Sarah Jane Adventures on our Wi-Fi, and Dad got a bill for like £1,200.
It can't be thousands.
It was like twelve hundred pounds in the olden days.
Yeah, it was expensive.
I mean, to be fair, it was ended up being a good thing, because we found out that we could have been on unlimited Wi-Fi for cheaper than the Wi-Fi we were on. So that all came out.
And because I blamed you, and because it was my son, and they waived the bill.
So it all turned out well.
Supported the Sarah Jane Adventures, so it's all good.
So let's pull everything together. We'll start round. We'll go around this way of the table. I think. Handbook to Happiness, do you have anything to add to our metaphorical book, Hunter, in regards to addiction, I guess?
I think just really identifying it, being open to it, and realizing that it's a very normal thing to try and find something as to help make yourself feel better, and really just trying to find other facets that you can do that from instead, really, that are healthier and better for you.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that I think Hunter's absolutely spot on. Finding coping mechanisms that are healthy coping mechanisms, because we all do need coping mechanisms. You know, life isn't easy and we all have stresses, especially nowadays. You know, more and more so, there is a lot more life stresses and a lot more pressures from society. So I think, you know, finding something that is something positive that you can put that into, a positive coping mechanism. I think also, like Paul said, looking at the people around you and how they're impacting you, how they're making you feel, because we often compare ourselves to those around us. So if they're behaving in destructive ways, we can think, oh well, it's not that bad because they do it. So surround yourself with people that aren't behaving in those ways, and I think also not being too hard on yourself, you know, and identifying, most importantly, who's made me feel bad and who's made me feel that I need to self-medicate, and finding the answers to dealing with that, a therapist, someone that can help you work through it.
I think also telling people about it as well. Don't feel like you're on your own with it. You're self-medicating, you're trying to get through it on your own, but really you're not. There's people around you can speak to, whether it's friends, family, whatever. Explain to them that you're going through something, you're trying to deal with something, and getting some support with that as well, I think.
And I think if you're asking for help, it's far easier to say, I need help because I am self-medicating with alcohol, I'm self-medicating with gambling. It will make you feel better, and it'll help the person that you're talking to understand that this is your...
I feel like it can be really hard though to say that I'm doing this, I'm sorry, and I need help. I think even just saying, just open up to people about whatever is making you self-medicate, and just looking for support with that matter in itself can be helpful. Absolutely. Rather than having to specifically say that, because people might be worried about how that will change people's perception of them and stuff like that. And even just saying,
struggling
with something else, you
absolutely.
Know, it could be helpful.
Great. Hunter, Nick, I mean?
Yeah, I've got a long one here because I've been making notes throughout this.
I will probably not have any then, because I'm hoping that all of them. Go on then, go for it.
How it goes. So the first thing is that I'd like to say is that it's normal to have an addiction, right, at some point in your life, because you're bound to be faced with some trauma in the past or in the future will, which will make you turn to something, right? So, you know, just take that on board. Everyone's the same. Everyone's got something. But you've got to start by holding that mirror to yourself and asking yourself, what am I justifying? Right? Because if you have to justify something, then fundamentally you know that it's wrong. And whatever that thing is that you're justifying, do you still want that in your life? Is it improving your life? Is it making your life worse? If you then identify something that you are addicted to and you want to quit, you've got to make that decision. You've got to say, like Paul said, I made a decision. I had a clear goal that I wanted to be teetotal and whatever that is for you. And then you've got to write down reasons why you want to quit, how that will improve your life, how keeping it will make your life negative. You then need to have a support network of people who you can tell and say, right, I've stopped doing this. I want you to know that I had an addiction to this. I'm not doing that anymore. You know, if I need your support, please, can you help? You've got to remove that temptation from your environment. So if it is alcohol, don't have any in the house. If it's, you know, if it's sugar, if it's sweets, don't have them in the house at all. And you've got to stay away from people that will trigger you. Those people that will go, well, just having one won't do you any harm. You don't want to be around that. You've got to stay away from those people. But you've got to spend more time with the people that support you, the people that will say, I'm really proud of you. I'm inspired by you. Spend more time around those people. And then when you... obviously, we talk about timeline all the time. You've got to look at timeline. Why did you turn to this in the first place? What was it that started it? And if you find that memory where you started it, so let's say it was the first time you had a drink of alcohol, the first time that you went in a shop and bought cigarettes, the first time that you had a cigarette, then look at that memory and restructure that memory. See yourself going in the shop, but this time instead of buying the cigarettes, see yourself buying something else. See yourself, instead of smoking the first cigarette, see yourself eating something else or doing something different. And when you restructure that memory and then pick the next five memories that really stand out in your mind of you with that addictive thing and restructure those, see yourself doing something different with those. So instead of eating that thing or smoking that thing, you're doing something different. And that will help to change things.
I think we've shared an abundance of help tips, positive things that you can do. If you are in a position that you're struggling with alcohol, positive intent, again, is something to consider. What is my positive intent of using this so that you can find a better alternative, as Liv suggested? And that positive that positive alternative, obviously, can be listening to our podcast, Handbook to Happiness. So thank you so very much to all of you Speakmans for this. I've really enjoyed this episode, and a huge thanks to Paul as well. I think we've discussed a taboo subject for many, and I hope that you, if you're a sufferer, if you are a family member of somebody that has an addiction, that you can now see actually that they're not addicted because they want to make your life harsh in any way. You don't choose to be addicted. This is a form of self-medication, and therefore we should have compassion for people who are struggling. But as we saw with Paul, as with the many people that we've helped, you know, once you find that cause and you address it, find better alternatives, you can live an addiction-free life. Really hope that you've found this episode enlightening, helpful, enjoyable. Obviously, if you have, we would love a 5-star review, and we'd love you to come back to listen to more. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for joining us. Wherever you're listening to this podcast today, do be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and we'd be incredibly grateful of a 5-star review.
Oh, and don't forget to recommend our podcast to your family and friends.
And if you'd like to have a look at some more free resources, take a look at our website, nickandeva.com.
If you want to drop us a question, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to admin@speakman.tv.
And you can follow us. We're at The Speakmans on all social media platforms. On YouTube, we're Handbook to Happiness Pod. If you are struggling, do be sure to speak to your general practitioner. And all that's left to say is that we appreciate you spending time with us today.